how would you describe the state of the world today? And he replied, lost in thought. We live in the stories that we devise, somewhat out of touch with what is actually occurring. Reflect for a moment. What kinds of thoughts did you think today? Were your thoughts useful? Were they relevant to the present experience and the task at hand? Sometimes when we look at our thoughts, we realize that they are actually not serving us. The mind has kind of run on automatic. It's out of our conscious control. We might find ourselves habitually judging our experience or trying to control what's going to happen next, even though we know we have no control over what's going to happen next. Often when we look at our thoughts, we realize these are not even the thoughts that I want to be thinking. There's a comic strip called Calvin and Hobbes. I don't know to what extent you get this Calvin and Hobbes comic strip, but Calvin is the little boy and Hobbes is the tiger. And when an adult is in the room, it's a stuffed tiger. And when just Calvin is around, he's an animated, tall, lanky kind of tiger. Calvin's buddy. And in this strip, it's basically Calvin thinking to himself. And he's thinking, here I am, happy and content. But not euphoric. So now I'm no longer content. I'm unhappy. My day is ruined. I need to stop thinking while I'm ahead. This happens to us sometimes. Nothing wrong is going on. He's just standing there. But the comparing mind judges our experience, and then somehow it's not good enough. Many people suffer from chronic comparing, from anxious worries, from seductive fantasies, or unrelenting planning, frequently thinking that things should be different than what's actually occurring. These kinds of thoughts may not be obviously evil. Perhaps, though, they're relatively useless. One time I was attending a retreat and I was in a small group interview. And the teacher of the retreat said very pointedly, very strongly to one woman who was describing her obsessive thinking about her ex-boyfriend. And he said, the teacher said to her, this is the most useless activity you could possibly engage in. It is a complete waste of time. And the group was like, oh, so direct. But it was true. And we all knew it. It was a little shocking to hear it so bluntly. She was a little embarrassed and a little shocked. But it's very true, very true. Are there times when you obsess over something that is past and you have no control over? Even if you just eliminated those thoughts from your mind, what a relief it would be. My teacher in India, Punjaji, used to say to people who were describing their past experiences, their past traumas, sort of their all the stories from the past, they would sometimes come to India and tell him all these things that had happened 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 40 years ago, of their kind of psychological and personal life. And he would say, you are digging in the graveyard, digging up rotting corpses. Again, very shocking in a way, but what a statement to realize that the thoughts of the past are really past. They're really gone. Too many meditators find that their own minds are spinning around obsessions of past or future, regretting the actions that were either done or not done, or lost in future anxieties, future storytelling, future fantasies, where we rehearse all the various responses we might make to all the various possibilities of an encounter or a conversation or an activity. One of the great saints from this land, Jesus, said, "Take no thought for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself." It simply, in contemporary language, might be a way of saying, don't be anxious about what may or may not happen in your future. Again, if we just eliminated those kinds of thoughts, those kinds of worries from our repertoire of suffering, what a relief it would be. Anxiety is caused sometimes just by the neurotic obsession we have with thinking about things that have never happened and may never happen. And actually, if we look at our minds, we find actually really mostly never happen. Mark Twain is credited with saying, "The worst things in my life never actually happened." Some people have a real knack for worrying and can be quite skilled at it. Maybe can turn almost anything, even a very minor event, into a major catastrophe. Often our obsessive thoughts have a rather negative bias. They might be affected by what we call aversive tendencies, thoughts of anger, thoughts of fear, thoughts of hate. But our obsessive thoughts can also be rooted in thoughts of desire, thoughts of lust, thoughts of greed. And when somebody was lost in thoughts of desire and lust and greed, Poonjaji used to say, thought is taking you to the supermarket. It's not your home. Thoughts have an enormous effect on our lives. But how closely have we examined our thoughts? How clearly are you aware of this process of becoming enchanted by the content of your own thoughts? Do you understand why certain thoughts intrigue you? Why they capture your attention? Why they're repeated in your minds? So much of our lives is actually spent seduced by thoughts, literally lost in thoughts. We forget sometimes to look beyond our fascination with the content of the thought, with the level of the narrative, the stories, in order to understand how thoughts operate, how they function. We must at times investigate, what are the causes for those thoughts to arise? What is the fuel that is sustaining the thinking? How do we become identified with and attached to those thoughts? And how do we go from a peaceful, clear, empty mind to the arising of a thought and then being swept up in a whole fabricated scenario of self in this drama? We become enchanted by the story, entrenched in mental patterns, and then experience the worry, the fear, the insecurity, the blame, the envy, the lust, all the various defilements that might come, whether the thought is a tragedy kind of drama or whether it's a kind of horror sort of film like I was very surprised on El Al. I was looking through what movies when I was flying here yesterday. I was looking through what movies they showed. You know, a zombie movie. There was only a choice of a couple. A zombie movie. I thought, they're going to show a zombie movie up in the air? I thought it was very strange because it's a scary movie, right? You don't really want your passengers on an airplane to be scared. But anyway. Sometimes we have zombie movies in our minds, some various kind of fictional scenario that scares us. So in meditation, we observe the process that's occurring. And what we're going to be focusing on in this retreat is the process of thinking. Notice if your thoughts are connected with the four kinds of attachment. And that list of four kinds of attachment is the attachment to sensual pleasures. To what extent are your thoughts basically, how can I get this that I want? The thoughts of wanting. The second is the attachment to views and opinions. Notice how frequently your thoughts are about your opinions about how things should be, your beliefs, your ideas. Notice any attachment to what are called rites, rituals, observances, methods. Those are thoughts about how things should be done. The attachment to the methods, the techniques, the ways we apply our effort, our various strategies for doing things, or the cultural customs of what should happen. For example, it's customary in most Buddhist meditation halls, not all of them, but most, to take one's shoes off. And here I am teaching this retreat, and I walked right in with my shoes. Did that agitate your mind at all? Probably not, because you were probably already aware that I had this little injury. But if you weren't aware, it might have looked a little bit odd. The fourth kind of obsessive thought and attachment, fourth kind of attachment, is to concepts of self, the attachment to I am. And often it manifests as I am like this. I am this kind of person. I am experiencing this. But instead of the emphasis being on the experience that we're mindful of, the emphasis is on the I becoming. In response to it. When thoughts proliferate, we're basically entangled in some form of attachment and clinging. There's a desire, there's a movement toward conceptual fixation. So when we're caught in thought, sometimes we can just pause and ask ourselves, which kind of attachment is going on right now? Is it towards sensual pleasure? Is it towards views and opinions? Is it towards methods and techniques? Is it towards the concept of self, of I am? As meditators, we're always on the lookout for attachment, for this contraction of clinging, because that's where suffering occurs. So we want to see it so that we can disentangle the mind from that movement. As you notice thoughts as discrete mental events, you might also begin to notice that thoughts are not one thing. There's many thoughts. One thought arises, and as it passes away, another thought may emerge. In fact, the arising of the next thought depends upon the passing of the first thought. There is not one thought that you had today. There were many, many, many thousands, maybe millions of thoughts that may have gone through your mind even in just one day. So one of the first steps that we're going to work with, one of the first strategies and exercises I want to do with you is to learn to recognize thought as a discrete mental event, as an event that wasn't occurring, has a beginning, ends, and then isn't occurring. It's a discrete event. It's not who you are. It's not a permanent experience. It's not lasting. You might even begin to notice a sense of a space between thoughts. Now, there's no physical space between thoughts. Thoughts aren't physical, but it's a sense of it. It's a sense of the discreteness of each thought, as though there's a transition or a gap before the next thought emerges. And it may be that you can discern that. It may even be that you can rest a bit in that. And in that resting, our fascination with the story very much diminishes. As our mindfulness develops, we become more and more aware of the dynamics of mind and how thoughts arise, how they affect us, and how they pass away. With increasing mindfulness, we'll see how those patterns operate that influence our reactions to things. How do thoughts affect our emotions and affect our choices and our decisions? How do they influence the intentions that we form and the intentions that we act on? What is the interplay between emotion and thought? How do thoughts lead into speech and lead into actions? Which thoughts lead into speech and actions, and which ones do not? What are the roots or the forces or the energy behind those thoughts that we choose to speak on or act on? Meditation is not about controlling our experience, and yet profound shifts do occur somewhat below the level of rational understanding. But in Buddhist practice, we do not reject the rational, analytical mind. But we do see the limitations of it, because the rational mind may not be capable of bringing about direct, liberating insights or full awakening. Basically, rationality is important, but it has limits. When we're mindful, when we're alert, when we're knowing things as they are, we don't need to analyze and categorize every experience. We use our intelligence skillfully, appropriately, as needed. But we're not a slave to that mode of thinking. Even if it's been well developed through your educational process, there are other ways of using the mind and using thought. So we develop in meditation a rather flexible, malleable, wieldy, clear, and discerning mind. We learn a lot about how we think, and we become a good friend of our own minds. A Tibetan teacher, Dujum Rinpoche, said, "Awareness becomes so open and spacious that there is always room for thoughts to arise." Can we make enough room in our minds for thoughts not only to arise, but to also pass, so that we're not caught up in them and we are not holding on to them? We're not pushing them away, and we're not only rejecting them from our meditative experience. We are, in effect, developing mindfulness of the mind. We're becoming attentive to mental phenomena and very sensitive to the quality of our mental states. Mindfulness of mind is a very important part of right mindfulness. As we observe mind in mind, we are developing what is known as the third establishment of mindfulness. How many people are familiar with Satipatthana practice? About half of you. The Satipatthana Sutta basically describes mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mind, and mindfulness of the various kinds of mental states that describe the functioning of this path of practice. So it's quite a comprehensive system of developing and working with mindfulness. And it is the resource or the sutta, the teaching of the Buddha, that most mindfulness, perhaps all mindfulness practices, are somewhat are indebted to or derived from. So as we observe the mind in the mind, and as we watch the mind's activities as activities, not just the story, we're not really interested in the story, we're looking at the activities of the mind, then we will see the quality of our mental states, but we'll also recognize that thoughts are just thoughts. They're utterly empty. They're ephemeral. They're insubstantial. There's really nothing about our thoughts that we need to worry about. By directly seeing the empty nature of thoughts, then we'll have an understanding of why there is no reason whatsoever to be attached to any story. Why cling? Why grasp? And why resist the thoughts? We might begin to laugh at our own minds the way we might laugh at a comedy movie or a theater production. We don't really need to identify with the characters that we play out to recognize that it's kind of a funny drama. We can rest with a mind that is bright, that is spacious, that is relaxed, that is at ease, that is undisturbed, that is centered, concentrated, collected. We can be aware of the empty, luminous clarity of the mind. Then we're not troubled by those moments when a defilement finds its way in, some moment of greed or hate, a worry, a plan, a regret, some distraction momentarily arises. It doesn't really disturb us too much because we have the wisdom that knows it's a thought. That's all it is. And a thought is just a thought, utterly empty. Then we can and we will work skillfully with anything that arises in our mental experience, in our conscious experience, in our experience of this present moment. So I'd like to end here, and we'll have a few minutes of silence just to let these thoughts settle.